Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Immigration is one of the most contentious issues in this presidential election, and by now, you probably know where both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump stand on the issue. But as a reminder, here's tape from both candidates at their respective national conventions earlier this summer.
Decades of record immigration have produced lower wages and higher unemployment for our citizens, especially for African American and Latino workers.
I believe that when we have millions of hardworking immigrants contributing to our economy, it would be self-defeating and inhumane to try to kick them out.
Well, Harvard economist George Borjas says both Clinton and Trump are half right about immigration and mostly wrong about their chosen sets of solutions. And why is that? Well, in Borjas's words, quote, immigration turns out to be another income redistribution program. He writes about it in his new book. It's called We Wanted Workers, Unraveling the Immigration Narrative. And he joins us now in the studio. Professor Borjas, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you. Well, first of all, you recently wrote in Politico magazine that you've never been cited officially or unofficially by a presidential candidate. And yet that happened when Donald Trump used that statistic about African-American Latino workers that we just heard. So what is he getting wrong then about immigration?
What each candidate is getting wrong is the following. Donald Trump is right in the sense that when immigrants come in, and particularly low-skill immigrants, they tend to have a depressing effect on the labor market opportunities of low-skill workers already here. But at the same time, those low wages translate into higher profit for the people who hire them. And that's the emphasis that Hillary Clinton tends to put on the data, that she's talking about the benefits as opposed to the costs. Mm. And that is the sense in which they're both right and wrong. Neither is telling the whole story.
Interesting. So Trump is looking at the costs. Clinton is looking at the benefits. Costs for individual workers, benefits for the nation.
Exactly right. And okay. Particularly for the employers.
Okay.
Particularly for the employers.
I see. Which is sometimes translated into GDP, another number that's thrown out.
Exactly.
The economy benefits overall. But for point of clarification here, though, are we talking about just legal immigration, or are you throwing in illegal immigration as well?
When we economists talk about immigration and the economic impact of immigration, we're really talking about all immigrants. And the reason for that is that the data that we use, census data, for example, don't really tell you who's legal and who's not legal. So therefore, we can only measure the increase in supply, the increase in the number of workers in total. So we're really talking about both legal and illegal.
Okay. So that complicates matters a little bit, but we're not afraid of complication
right
here. So let's dig a little bit deeper into this. So as you're saying, you believe that Donald Trump is right in focusing on and saying that some workers, particularly low-skilled, low-wage workers, native, quote-unquote native workers, do suffer an impact with increased immigration. Do you have a particular sense of how much of an impact?
Probably at the very low end of the labor market, the wage of high school dropouts, many of whom happen to be Hispanic, U.S.-born natives, or Black Americans, African Americans, the wage has probably gone down by something to 3 to 5% as a result of immigration in the last 20 or 30 years. Mm. So that would be the number we're talking about, which is not a huge number, except that a 3 to 5% wage drop at the very low end is a sizable amount for the disadvantaged workforce.
But how does that 3 to 5% then compare to the other enormous forces that have contributed to wage stagnation overall? I mean, outsourcing of jobs, trade, things like that.
It only contributes to it partly. You cannot claim that immigration is the main contributor to the decline in the fortunes of low-skilled workers. But it's exacerbated the problem. That would be a way to think about it.
Okay. Then on the flip side, then how much of a benefit to the employers, as you say,
right,
do these immigrants provide?
Well, the number that people threw around, including the National Academy report that was published a couple of weeks ago, is that the nation as a whole, mainly because of the increased profits to employers, has gained about $50 billion a year due to the contribution of immigrants in the labor market. But that number you have to contrast also with the fact that if you have a lot of low-skill immigration, you tend to have many more expenses in social service programs. And those two numbers basically offset each other. So once you account for the increased expenditures in social service programs, particularly education and welfare, you basically tend to see that the gain to the nation as a whole is more or less, it's not far from zero.
Right.
So what you're really seeing is that immigration more or less leaves the economic pie of natives untouched, but changes how the pie is split. And it changes how the pie is split in the following way. People who compete with immigrants tend to lose. And those happen to be people who are low-skilled workers, as well as people in the H-1B program, for example, high-tech workers. You hear a lot of stories in the New York Times, for example, about how high-tech workers had to train their foreign-born replacements, right? So anybody who competes with immigrants tends to lose out. But then the people who use immigrants, and that includes not just the employers, but also middle-class families, upper-middle-class families that hire immigrants to do household work and so on, they tend to gain a lot. So it's really a changing in the split.
You know, I was looking at that National Academy's report you're talking about, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. And just to reiterate, I mean, also specifically in Massachusetts, for example, they said that the initial cost to the state is higher for immigrants because of largely the cost of educating their children, but that in the second and third generation, it's a wash. And in fact, many of those immigrants end up doing a net contribution to the state.
Look, if you take one of the things the National Academy report did was to basically track an immigrant over the next 75 years. If you track this immigrant over the next 75 years as he has children and grandchildren, then it all depends on what the future looks like. And you have to make assumptions about that. Hmm. And in the report, as opposed to the press release, they actually vary a lot of us. They make very different assumptions, which lead to very different numbers.
Yeah.
So from my point of view, really what's most credible is what's happening today. And, you know, there's no doubt about the fact that in Massachusetts and in the nation as a whole, immigrants, because they tend to be disproportionately low skill, do create a fiscal imbalance.
Well, so I want to talk with you about then what your recommended solutions would be, policy prescriptions. But before I get there, let me just ask you, are you an immigration skeptic? That's how you've been described.
I'm not an immigrant. No, I'm an immigrant realist. I mean, what's really wrong with the immigration debate is that you have people on the two extreme sides either seeing everything that is good about immigrants, increased wealth and so on and so forth, or everything that is bad about immigrants in terms of lower wages and so on, right? The fact of the matter is that both things are true at the same time. And this is where you can actually get into the policy debate. By looking at it from these extremes, we're basically stuck as to how to proceed. But if you look at it more realistically, which is, look, some people are winning and some people are losing, that might provide a way forward in the debate by sort of pointing out that there are monies to be made and there are people to be benefited by redistributing wealth around.
There are some people who take issue with your assertion that even in the short term, that low-wage workers do suffer a negative impact from immigration. I mean, you know well the work of David Card at the University of California, Berkeley. You two have sparred over specific studies regarding the Mariel Boatlift.
Yes.
He disagrees with you. I mean, there was another study that just came out last year from the National Bureau of Economic Research that said that some of your studies regarding Miami and the Mariel Boatlift had suffered confirmation bias because you were looking at such a small number of low-wage workers that the impact couldn't really be measured
accurate. Let me explain very easily what the critique of my Mariel work was about, okay? The critique actually, believe it or not, looked at workers who were 16 to 61 years old. Now, that means that people who are 16, 17, and 18 years old were considered to be high school dropouts because they are high school students who don't yet have a high school diploma. And that clearly makes no sense whatsoever. Once you take teenagers out of the data, it is very clear that if you look at a sample of workers that represents the prime age male workforce in Miami, there was a big drop in wages for high school dropouts.
Hmm. What about a sort of broader level point of view that comes from, say, the Migration Policy Institute? We were looking at kind of an older paper from them, granted, it was from 2010, and it was talking about the difference between short-term and long-term impacts of immigration, which is rather important, especially if the economy at any point in time that you're looking at is a down economy, the short-term impacts are much stronger, right? So they were saying, but in the long term, not only do immigrants not reduce, they don't reduce native employment, but since they increase productivity, average income as on the nation as a whole goes up.
Okay, there's two issues there. Number one is in the short term, you get the negative impact. Just think of what would happen to your salary, for example, and to your job opportunities if all of a sudden we have an H-1B program that allowed 50,000 radio persons to come in, right, annually.
I'm more likely to be replaced by a computer, but okay, that's a different
issue. But clearly that would have an impact, even though your employer would benefit. It has a lot more people to choose from. In the long term, what would happen is two things. One is the economy will adjust. So what economists tend to find, and actually the economic models tend to predict, is that on average, the economy will look just like it looks now. But the fact of the matter is that there will still be distributional impact. The people who had a lot of immigrants coming into their jobs will be slightly worse off than the people who did not. That's number one. Number two, you're talking about innovation and productivity increases in the long term. That's highly possible if you look at a very high school immigration. And that's where economists have spent a lot of time trying to look at it. And the evidence, unfortunately, is not clear cut. There are some studies that look at the impact of very high school immigrants on productivity, and they tend to find very, very nice positive impacts. But other stories are less clear on that.
Right. I acknowledge that one of the reasons why this issue is so fraught is because there are such a variety of different studies and approaches to the analysis of the data that we have. And the data itself aren't even perfect.
Exactly.
And then which what makes it...
Let me actually give you a statistic to show you how imperfect the data are.
Yeah.
One group of people we care about are, for example, low-skilled Mexican immigrants. If you look at census data, amazing as it may seem, about 40% of the wage data for low-skilled Mexican immigrants who just arrived in the country is completely made up by the census because those people don't report the wage.
Right.
So it's just imputed.
Yeah. Well, so one of the reasons why I was very eager to speak with you is because of the policy prescriptions that you put forward based on your, you know, what we were talking about earlier, that neither Trump nor Clinton have it fully right. And the reason why it's so compelling to me is because seems like, given what your prescriptions are, which we'll talk about in a minute, absolutely nobody wants to do what you suggest. and here's why. Because you've written basically that, and these are your words from an article that you had in Politico. We're going to link to it at radioboston.org. That you say that there's a wealth redistribution that happens from workers to employers when we have immigration. So you say the total wealth redistribution from the native losers to the native winners is enormous, roughly $500 billion a year. And so, therefore, you suggest that we should put in place policies that redistribute that wealth from the employers back down to workers.
Exactly. And the way to think about it is this. Immigrants redistribute, you know, the labor market impact of immigrants is to redistribute wealth. There are some employers that gain a lot. For example, Bill Gates claims that for every H-1B visa holder that Microsoft hires, Microsoft creates 4 new jobs. If that were true, well, let's take it at face value. If that were true, he's making an awful lot of profit from that one visa holder, right? Let's make him pay for it.
So
exactly.
Put a tax on
charge him for an H-1B visa and redistribute that wealth to the workers that the New York Times reports are basically retraining their replacements.
And so what about then at the lower skill? I mean, think like agriculture workers.
The same thing. And there are employers that are gaining dramatically from the employment of low-skill workers. And right now, that money is going to the employer's bank account. Why not use some of that money to redistribute and make better off the low-skill natives that lost out? Now, the problem with doing that is that the employers are not going to give up all that extra money.
It's a complete political non-starter.
That's the reason that We have to begin to think about immigration policy in a much broader way. We have to not just worry about how many immigrants to admit and which immigrants to admit, but how to make sure that the people left behind don't get left behind.
Right. So I just want to reiterate that, I mean, I feel very compelled by these ideas. But again, I would say both Democrats and Republicans, the parties themselves, are so beholden to the moneyed interest of the very employers you're speaking of that this conversation, does anyone even listen to you ever?
I doubt it. To be completely honest, I doubt it. But Hopefully, it's a way to think about the problem. We have to worry. I mean, look at the political debate today. The people who are left behind by immigration and trade are part of the political debate. And it's about time we address that problem.
Well, they're driving the debate in many ways.
Exactly.
What about some other issues which may seem more, not necessarily politically feasible, but have received some discussion? I mean, there's always talk about, would raising the minimum wage have any impact here? Especially for those low-wage workers.
Yeah, I don't know if it would or not in the long term, okay, to be completely honest, because we know that raising the minimum wage also has employment effects. Employers might not want to hire people who are very expensive.
In the short term,
In the short term. So it's not really clear whether that will solve the entire problem. I mean, I think we have to address the immigration problem directly. And the way to address it is by beginning to think about immigration, not just as how many immigrants we're going to have, but also as to how to ensure that those most negatively affected by immigration are left behind.
Now, what about, I mean, I believe in the past you've also shown some support for becoming more selective, the nation becoming more selective in the kinds of immigrants that we let in.
That's a possibility as well. And then what you have to ask is, what does the U.S. want to accomplish from immigration policy? If what the U.S. wants to accomplish from immigration policy is to become a wealthier country, then by all means, let's admit all the high-skilled immigrants that we want to admit, because that is where the wealth will come in. Like you were talking about before, through innovation and productivity increases, right? But in fact, historically, the U.S. has chosen not to do that. The U.S. has really played an incredible role by providing hope to a lot of very poor people from all over the world. And to the extent that we care about that, that is not a bad thing to do. So the question then really becomes, what do you want to accomplish?
So I keep hearing you for your call to really take a hard look at the domestic effects immediately.
Exactly.
Well, we'll see if anyone is willing to listen to you after November 8th.
Thank you.
George Borjas is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His new book is We Wanted Workers, Unraveling the Immigration Narrative. Very interesting to speak with you. Thank you so very much, and I hope to speak with you again sometime in the future.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.